We hope you enjoy this episode of the Modern Divorce Podcast. But first, an important message for our listeners.
Embarking on a new chapter? Zach Knutzman of the Darwin Wall team at Realty One Group is your go-to real estate expert in Arizona, specializing in guiding couples and families through their real estate needs while experiencing a divorce. Modern Law's trusted partner, Zach, brings expertise, confidence, and compassion to your real estate journey. Let him help you navigate this challenging time. Zach Knutzman, your modern solution in real estate. Visit ZachSellsAZ.com to get started. Welcome to another episode of the Modern Divorce Podcast. We've got another special edition candidate here with us today, a candidate for Maricopa County Attorney's Office, Gina Godby here. Gina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm so happy that you're here. We in the East Valley have recently had our eyes very, very closely fixed on the justice system and on local politics because it's become so relevant recently. And I don't know that it was for a lot of us. So I really appreciate you being here to talk about your candidacy, your background, how you would approach some of the problems that we're seeing. So before we dive into that, would you tell us a little bit of background about you and what brought you to where you're at now?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm a fourth generation Arizona native. I live in the West Valley. I'm a mother of two daughters, and my husband and I have lived in the Goodyear area for about 30 years now. Before that, I started my career with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office as a prosecutor. I spent 25 years there. I managed a manager for 16 of those years. I tried over 100 cases, mainly gangs, violent crimes, homicide cases, and I trained hundreds of prosecutors in my time there. I stepped down in about 2021 to be the city prosecutor in Goodyear, where I had exposure to seeing a number of cases that used to be felonies being downgraded to misdemeanors and sent to the city. After that, that pretty much inspired me to run for Maricopa County attorney in 2022 at that point. But the Board of Supervisors appointed the current county attorney, my opponent, and I had a huge disadvantage of trying to compete against an opponent. But I stepped in the race because I felt we were not holding offenders accountable. I felt that we were not supporting law enforcement like we should. And that we had real issues we needed to deal with between our rise in homelessness, mental health issues, and our addiction. We had a drug problem, and this was back, especially in 2022, because we had violent crime spiking of people under the influence of drugs. So because of that, and I felt we had so many issues in our criminal justice system that needed to be addressed, I jumped in the race. I didn't win in 2022, but I came close in the primary. And then I became the last year I spent, and I've been a crime victims' rights attorney. So I represent victims of crime. And I knew back then that we were not holding people accountable. We've gone soft on crime. We weren't supporting law enforcement. I had no idea that we were doing a disservice for crime victims. So that's kind of my background and what led me to jump back in the race, because my phone kept ringing for the last several months of people asking me to run, people who were just disheartened and disappointed in the criminal justice system, and not just, you know, the Gilbert community that you've followed, but the Goodyear community with that Goodyear bicyclist case. I don't know if you know about that. That's been a real tragedy too. And so I heard from crime victims across the valley in law enforcement that it was time for me to step back in the race and try to make a difference.
So taking a huge step back, mm-hmm. I moved here from Oregon, and I had always heard that Arizona was super tough on crime, locked up everybody, just put up a tent in the desert and put people in there. So was that impression wrong?
You know, when I started, I think that was troubling for me, because when I started in 96, we had a tough on crime. We were tough on crime under the Romney administration, and then the Thomas administration, the Montgomery administration. And in about 2020, things started to change and started to change concerningly. I was in the office at that time. It became more important to try to divert as many cases and send them to the city and downgrade cases. So you're right. When we were there, and that's where I'm looking at where we are right now. And if you have time, I'd love to go over this diversion policy that the county attorney uses that should concern everybody. But we have real issues right now, and we are diverting violent offenses. We're diverting cases, even when victims of crime are objecting. We're still sending them into diversion, and our victims have lost their voice in the current criminal justice system. So someone who spent my career fighting for this community since 96, I don't like what I'm seeing one bit. And we have real threats coming across the border. We have an unsecured border. We had 42,000 unaccounted for minors that we don't even know if they're going to end up in the sex trafficking or human trafficking areas. We have gangs coming over from the South America that are committing all these burglaries. And we have territorial fights occurring in Maricopa County and our state right now, that it is concerning that we've gone soft on crime, and we have to reprioritize and start holding people accountable, or we're going to be in trouble.
I think it's so hard. It's a hard thing to balance the concept of, you know, putting a ton of people in jail and taking them out of the economy and taking them away from their families is generally not ideal. And so it makes sense that we as a society are thinking about making sure that we're locking people up who should be locked up for the right amount of time. And figuring that out has to be challenging. The answer can't just be anybody who commits a crime goes away for as long as possible, right?
Yeah, you know, but we usually only lock up people, and that's a great question. But your very first time, unless it's a violent crime, everybody gets probation. Your second time is, instead of maybe not stipulating to probation, but it's a no agreements where judges usually give you probation, you're not usually looking at any prison time to at least your third felony. That's the reality of the situation. And sometimes it's even gotten worse, that it's more than your third felony. Unless it's a gun or a violent crime, like a home invasion, shooting, obviously, then you're probably going to jail your very first time. But there's also a misconception that we're locking up drug users. In 1996, Arizona actually passed a law to get treatment first. We've been a treatment first state since 1996, which means your first and second time, at one time, you couldn't even get jail. It was just probation and treatment. It's been changed over the years, because what we've learned is, if you don't have that carrot and stick approach and you just tell people you have to come in, they come in. I swear, I used to do these courts. And it's funny, because I think sometimes they were under the influence when they walked in, and they were told by their attorney, you can reject probation now and walk away, or you can go on probation to get treatment. What do you think they said? Reject probation and walked away. And so then they had to actually go in and say, well, if you reject probation, then you could get jail. You know, so we had to evolve and learn over the past 20 some years. But if you talk to people, they're still going to tell you that somebody's being locked up for drug offenses. That's just not happening. Maybe if they have like a drive-by shooting and a drug offense, and they're rejecting probation on the drug offense and they're going to prison on both, then it could look like maybe they're in prison on a drug offense. But typically that will never happen just with drugs. And the only time that I can ever see, and this might be a little into the weeds, I tend to get in the weeds sometimes, so apologize, but maybe if somebody served all their time, then they just have like time served. They'll go to prison for time served and they walk out the next day. That's about the only time that anybody's ever going to prison on your first couple drug offenses. It's just not happening.
That's all very interesting and kind of high level. And I appreciate you taking the time to go through that with me. And your background and why you're running. So I live in Gilbert and have been watching very closely the handling of the Preston Lord murder and the Gilbert Goons cases. Are those cases that you're familiar with?
Yes, I've been following them as well over the last couple months. And I'm just very sad for the whole community. And I know the family who are just waiting to have answers. So my heart does go out to all of them.
Yeah, it's been crazy to watch so closely, because you know you live in the justice system, and so you see it from the moment it gets, you know, on your desk. But in this particular case, we're seeing the crime, on video. Then we're seeing when the police get involved and how they get involved. And then we're seeing what the Maricopa County Attorney's Office does with those crimes. And in what we've seen, there have been a ton of crimes that weren't really investigated by police. Arrests weren't made. And recently, there were arrests made on old crimes. Charges were submitted, and Maricopa County Attorney's Office declined to press charges. And it's troubling. It's troubling to watch, you know, a victim say this person did it, and here's all this evidence. You know, here's the social media, here's the police report, here's this guy in a video, and have Maricopa County Attorney's Office say, we're not going to prosecute it. Like, why would that happen?
You know, I can't get into the details of that because I don't know all the facts, but I can sense the frustration. And the only thing I could tell you is because I live in Goodyear, and I'm going to take a moment and tell you about the Goodyear case, because they're feeling the exact same thing that Gilbert's feeling right now. In that Goodyear bicyclist case, it was one of the largest bicycling accidents in our state. There were 19 people almost a year ago, last Sunday, were driving down the road two by two by two, and the defendant in his car drove over them, rolled over 19, killing two, and he tried to claim that his steering froze, but the car has been looked at multiple times from multiple individuals, and they can't see anything wrong with the car. He had marijuana in his system, but he tried to claim it was from the night before, not then, so we didn't have that legal limit. And the troubling thing was he didn't brake. And so felony charges were turned down. They were turned down and sent to the city as misdemeanors. And I think it shocked everybody involved. How can you say that's not at least negligent of what happened? And right. And the families, I mean, the people that are injured, the families, they're devastated. They're devastated and they don't understand it. So I don't know. I can't explain some of the decisions that are being made. I can't explain some of the policies that are being made. And some of these voices of these victims are the reason that I answered, because people are mad, they're upset, and they've lost confidence in the county attorney's office.
I think it's just there's just not enough communication to make it make sense. And that I'm not just talking about even the county attorney level, like the whole thing, just watching these things happen, you know, determining who is investigating crimes and when and how they get charged and what plea agreements get made. It just doesn't make sense to the public. And I think the public wants to understand. So you and Rachel Mitchell are both Republicans, right?
Yes.
Do you have certain identifiable political differences in your positions?
I think the biggest difference is that there would be a lot. We're both career prosecutors. We both care about the community and public safety. We both represented victims. The difference between Rachel and myself is I believe that we have to be a lot stronger in enforcing the law. And maybe because I have a violent I have a background with violent crimes, homicides, shootings. So when I saw things like the Charles Ryan case, where I don't know if you're aware of that, where my opponents said on TV that we took an account that he drank all of that tequila. But voluntary intoxication is not a defense. And in
let's give some people some background on this, because I do think that it's a great example. It's something that we should talk about. So what is the Charles Ryan example?
So the Charles Ryan, it was an individual who used to be the director of the prisons. He was drinking, fired his gun in his house, police were called, and there was a standoff with police. And according to the victim officers in their victim impact statement that they wrote to the court, he pointed the gun at them for 15 seconds. He barricaded himself into the house. They had to shut down the neighborhood. They had to spend extensive resources out there to try to take him into custody. And it lasted for a substantial period of time. And he did point the gun at them. Typically, when that happens under the the policy of the county attorney's office, when you point a gun at a police officer, you're supposed to go to prison. It is one of those violent crimes that usually results in a prison sentence. In this case, even though Tempe police filed it as a class two, the county attorney charged it as a six disorderly conduct. And at that time, my opponent said that there was no information that he really pointed the gun for an extended period of time. And I remember back in 2022, I was concerned about that because there's no requirement in an aggravated assault case for a pointing. Pointing is not required. It is so reasonable apprehension.
Bigwig at the prison system gets drunk, has some sort of a meltdown, shoots his gun inside his house. Police get called. There's a standoff between him and police where he points a gun at police. And he is charged with disorderly conduct.
He is charged with disorderly conduct. And then 2 years go by. He was just sentenced recently. And at the sentencing, even though the two victim officers asked the court to reject the plea and asked for consequences because he did point the gun, the defendant was given six opens and he was given no jail, didn't serve a day in jail, and six opens. So it looks like a sweetheart deal was given to a political insider. And this is why some of the people don't have trust in the criminal justice system.
Well, right. None of that like feels good, because we know if this was not a bigwig, if he had been Black, if he had been Hispanic, it would have been a justifiable shooting. That is the reality of what we have watched. And so it makes me so uncomfortable to watch the justice system play out in such an unfair way.
Well, I think that's the total thing, because I was a manager for over 16 years and I trained attorneys, and there's a cardinal rule. You treat similarly situated defendants the same. Justice is supposed to be blind. And so when you see this, it is almost impossible to be able to compare this case to every other case in the criminal justice system and how it's handled. And I know that they tried to explain it away, and I'm sure, I think, but it ignored the norm and the written policy that said what the norm is, and that is prison. So I'm troubled by decisions like this that are being made that have had weight of why people don't trust the criminal justice system. And I'd love to go over a little more, if you got a second, to tell you something else that's just shocking.
Definitely. And then I'd really like to know from you, if you were in this position, how would you make sure that people of different races and different socioeconomic statuses are treated similarly when there's so much discretion built into every single level? So I'd really like your opinion on that. But please tell me.
Absolutely. I'll do that first. So every time we were given a deviation, what they call a deviation, where they would ask for a different plea under the plea agreement, it had to be something unique and something different. It's not that this is an aberration. He comes from a good family, because what about the people that came from a bad family and didn't get a chance? It's either a good family or a bad family. Usually we looked at the circumstances of the case. And so that is always done. But in this case, most defendants, a lot of them get into these situations, and it could be that suicide by cop situation. But that's unfair to the officers, because you're putting the officer in a situation where they're fearing for their lives, so they will shoot you, because that's your goal. Your goal is to put them at fear so they shoot you. And officers did not join the forces to be executioners. And when they have to be in that situation, it is high stress for them. There's emotional damage that it creates to them. And it's not fair to those officers to be put in that situation. So we've always had to weigh that. Typically, maybe we didn't give them the same plea as if you shot at a police officer. We did acknowledge the fact that maybe you had mental illnesses and that led to it. So we would give you something less. But to give you disorderly conduct with an open and not any jail, that's concerning. And now then you have to worry about the ripple effect. So now what are you going to do to all these other defendants who are now submitting deviations saying, well, I was drinking that night, I was on drugs that night, are you going to give me a break? And if you are, that should concern everybody in the public, because most of the people that commit violent crimes are under the influence of either drugs or alcohol. A large number of them are. So if we're going to now suddenly make an excuse, even though keep in mind, it's not a legal defense, you know, a jury's told voluntary intoxication is not a defense. But now this county attorney, my opponent, is saying she's going to use it as a defense for charging. That's frightening of what is going to happen going forward with all this violence we are facing in the community that's increasing if you look at the news.
Right. I agree with you. But if you were in this position, how would you make sure that people are treated fairly and that there are not disparate treatment of people based on their socioeconomic status and their race?
I think you impose your written plea offers. There was a written plea offer in this case that that the county attorney went from a class 2 to we charge it as a 6, and now we're going to no jail, 6 open. This was a major, major deviation that was done at the highest office. I would never have done that.
Okay, let me break this down a little bit. So it was initially charged by the county attorney as a class 2 felony. Is that correct?
It was submitted to the police department as a class 2 and then charged as a 6.
Submitted by the police to the county attorney?
Yes.
Okay. And then there was a plea agreement under that charging, under the class 2 felony?
Under the class 6 disorderly.
But how did it go from the 2 to the 6?
Well, that was a decision by the county attorney to file it as the 6, not the 2.
Oh. And so the cop said, hey, I think this qualifies as the class 2. And then the county attorney got it and they said, I don't think so. I think we're going to charge it as a class 6. And then under those guidelines, it allowed for a plea deal.
Yeah. And so as a class 2 dangerous, a presumptive is 10.5 to 21 flat. Got dropped to a 6. Presumptive still is prison because there was a gun involved. Presumptive's 2.25. So that is even under a disorderly. That's the presumptive sentence. And it could have been mitigated to 1.5 years. Instead, it was done as a non-dangerous probation, no jail.
This seems to make a lot of sense. So there was another case where Adam Zodrov hit a kid randomly, Kevin Durkin, at Desert Ridge In-N-Out. And Kevin Durkin lost 7 teeth. Adam Zodrov led to something that didn't involve these brass knuckles as a deadly weapon and got 6 months in prison. So, and then this came up in the brass knuckles discussion. Well, we don't need a brass knuckles ban because it's already a deadly weapon. But if they're not being charged, if the charges are being lessered, if the prosecutors are ignoring these aggravating factors, how does that provide any accountability?
Well, I would agree. The brass knuckles are a dangerous instrument, and anything could be a dangerous system. A bat, knuckles, it's the manner in which it's used, could be a dangerous instrument. Steel-toed boots, I've seen that where they kick them and they're steel-toed boots. We've used those as dangerous instruments. But it is the discretion of the prosecutor to file that as a weapon. And that changes the nature of the charges. And that goes back to what we were saying. Unfortunately, we have taken this shift. And now it's almost a society. We've gone to a society of excuses. We're not holding people accountable. And so if you choose to give them a break because they were drinking or because some other one, and you give them not just a little break because maybe you have a mental health or maybe you're taking other things into consideration. This was a drastic one. And I think that's why you had the defense bar and so many people complaining and concerning, because it looks like it was special treatment for a political insider.
Absolutely. So when prosecutors have their discretion, how much of that actually gets to the county attorney?
Well, because the county attorney sets the policies, mm-hmm. If they're within policy, it doesn't have to go up to the county attorney. Usually it could be at a bureau level or a division level, depending on how, like a flee to the lead or a shooting case would have to be a higher level than maybe, a burglary case that you're pleading down or something. But the county attorney in this case, My opponent, she did say this was her call, and she did make the call and agree with that call. And that call is what is just troubling, because now we're going to have the ripple effects. It's not this case. It's going to be the cases that come, and potentially for the next, hopefully for only a year. And I could put a stop to that, of how many cases that we're going to be giving this lenient treatment to. And I want to just, if I may, talk about the same pattern of going soft on crime. If you look under the county attorney's diversion policies, August 3rd, 2023, it outlines everything that they're doing for diversion. And this should trouble every single person. It's not my word. You don't have to take my word for it. You could take the county attorney's own word of my opponent. And it's showing that our system is infected. And right now we've gone soft on crime. Diversions are being offered for burglaries, theft, robberies, assaults, unlawful flights, not just drug offenses, resisting arrest. And I want to take a moment with the unlawful flight, because that's, if you think of this unlawful flight, this is something that's kind of a so concerning of mine. An unlawful flight situation, people used to flee the police because they don't want a ticket. They don't want to stop. Maybe they're committing a crime and they're fleeing a shoplifting or another offense. Police used to be able to, 25 years ago, pursue them. But we know what happened. If you see any TV or anything, when you flee, these people don't want to stop. They're fleeing maybe a felon, or they have other reason to flee. They disregard the safety of the other drivers on the road. They run stop signs. They run lights. They flee. And every year across, it used to be in our state, somebody would die during a flight. And then the city would get sued. And then they questioned the police of why they pursued them. And what happened was all of the police departments put in policies to stop pursuing. And so the number of pursuits that we even got was so lessened, because unless you had like an air unit going over to be able to monitor them, they couldn't catch them because they just fled and the police couldn't pursue them. So if an air unit can keep an eye on them and we can ID them, we were able to bring them into the system. So for 20 years, we used to say that's a designated felony because you disregarded the public, and we're going to send a message to you that flights are not acceptable. And we didn't necessarily, it doesn't mean prison. It just meant you had a designated felony on your record. Now, I look at this number, 107 people who had unlawful flight last year were given diversion, which means a couple of classes and the cases were dismissed. So that tells me, in that all the people who could flee, most of them could get away with it because the police can't follow. And then if the few that were actually caught, now you're going to give them diversion and have no consequence on the record. I don't know how we've gone this far, but it's frightening. It's frightening to me. It should be frightening to every citizen out there. If we want to make sure that we keep our state, I'm a fourth generation native. I am worried about how homelessness is getting worse, crime is getting worse, and with these borders coming over, we better change course or we're in trouble. And that's just one of the reasons. This diversion policy tells you that we're messed up in our priorities. You look under it says other charges that went to diversion: endangerment, unlawful imprisonment, kidnapping, arson of an occupied structure, going on, and this whole list, including impersonating a police officer. Why are we giving these cases diversion?
So this, what you're telling me, this report is from the last year?
It is the dated August 3rd, 2023. And it is showing what occurred during the latest one was 2022. We do not have the 2023 numbers. I want to see the 2023 numbers. But what I'm being told by people in the system, the washout calendar of diversion is terrible. And that means these are the people that failed to appear. So I don't expect these numbers to be any better.
Can you tell me what it says for domestic violence?
It's not listed. Let me look here. It's not listed. It's just listed as assault. So I don't know. But 6.3 assaults. I do know in my role as a victim's attorney that I could tell you I've never seen it before. I got the domestic violence diversion. They're allowing diversion even when victims object. That never happened. I was a city prosecutor. We didn't allow We didn't allow diversion when victims object. I don't know anybody that ever did that. Never happened under, again, the the Montgomery, the Romley, the Thomas administration, that we always honored what victims said. Victims have lost their voice. And the other thing that's interesting to me is you look under diversion for domestic violence, it said like a low to moderate range, you get 10 classes and your case could be dismissed. Moderate to high is 20 classes. Do you know every city that I'm aware of gives 26 sessions before of a diversion? Why is a felony less than a city? So these are some of the things that that I want to point out and more of how we have gone soft on crime and why we need to take a look at it. And I know the media wants to say everything's great. The county attorney is hard. She's hard on crime. That's not what we're seeing.
I only very recently began paying attention. And when I started watching her, she inspired confidence. She seemed like someone who was very competent and could absolutely get the job done. Watching things a little closer, it just seems like something's seriously off.
You know, and it's not personal. I have worked with my opponent for 25 years, and I liked her, but we're talking about this change, and she's not seeing it. And I don't know if it's because I've tried over 100 cases and mostly violent crime cases. When I see someone go up there telling me you have to point to have an aggravated assault, immediately I become concerned. When I see some of these decisions that they're downgrading and offering diversion for, I have a history of these cases. It troubles me and bothers me because these cases can be just as impactful to the victims as some of the other cases. I remember one victim, even a lot of people say property offenses, and there's this thought, oh, it's just a property offense. But I've had victims who've had all of the memorabilia of a lost loved one stolen. That's not just a property offense that they just forget that easy. I've seen juveniles go into a house and party and destroy every item in a house, every item from every tile to just terrible devastation in a house. And the families there, I remember that victim said, these are the reasons we have locks on our doors and distrust in our hearts. These cases matter too. And there's just this thought now that so many victims and are forgotten in our criminal justice system. And that's sad. We have to rebalance and we have to return the voice to crime victims.
What are your thoughts on the juvenile justice system?
The juvenile justice system, I was a bureau chief and an attorney in the juvenile justice system. It has a role to rehabilitate, to try to help them, to give them the treatment and needs they have so they don't reoffend and end in the criminal justice, the adult system. I think it's a good plan. Unfortunately, it's a great example I want to say on the side where we have to remember our criminal justice system is not just rehabilitation. It's also deterrence. It's also incapacitation, and it is punishment too. It has to be all of it. In the juvenile system, though, the primary goal is rehabilitation. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work because people commit more crime and end up in the adult system, which I tell people when they want to just focus on rehabilitation, it doesn't always work. If it worked, it would be perfect in the juvenile system and we'd never see them again. That doesn't unfortunately happen, especially some of our youth who have come from difficult families, have substance abuse or drug addiction, end up usually committing violent crimes and end up in the adult system. In fact, as a homicide attorney, I can't tell you a large percentage of my cases were committed, violent cases were committed by juvenile offenders.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah.
How much does this position pay?
I don't even know.
I have no idea.
Maybe it's 100. I don't even know. I would be guessing. That tells you I'm not in it because I have no idea. I'm in it because if you know the train is broken, and I've seen it, I've been somebody in the trenches from the very beginning trying to create programs and highlight issues and fix them. I was on the team in 1996 that started the very first juvenile drug court. I started the juvenile transfer offender program to deal with the juveniles that end up in the adult system many years later. That's still in existence today. So there's so many programs and things that I've started that one of the things that troubled me being in the trenches and seeing it is that we were not, we have all these issues in our criminal justice system that we could do better. We are triaging a problem. And with homeless and mental health and access to treatment, we had real issues. And I think it's been 4 years. And I'd ask you this, do you think the homeless population, everything's getting worse? It's not getting better. But yet we continue to do things the same way that we have for 20 years, except for apparently making things easier on diversion. When you keep doing things the same way and you don't ever, and you're so worried if the train's running on time, you don't take a step back to even ask if we're heading in the right direction. And that's what frustrated me, because I see it. I knew we had issues. I knew we needed to fix it. And back when I left the county, and this would have been 2020, it was a dangerous precedence, because my bureau was called in and they said, you're charging too many cases. You need to send more cases to the city. And I remember asking them at that point, what are you talking about? We're winning our cases. We're getting good pleas. There's no issues with our cases. I didn't know that this charging standard was reasonable likelihood of conviction unless you met a quota, some unknown quota. I can't tell my attorneys that. And I think that was the reason I stepped down and moved to homicide by last year. I thought, you know what? I think it's time for me to step out of management, move to homicide. And I was going to finish my career there and retire until the city of Goodyear called me and brought me over. Because we were going in this bad direction and nobody was listening. And sometimes when you're doing that, you have a choice. Then I moved over to Goodyear and I saw the ramifications of this. Serious cases that used to be felonies downgraded to misdemeanors ending up in our cities. Do you know almost every city doesn't have supervised probation? So when you downgrade felonies to misdemeanors, you send them to cities, they're not equipped for that. If a person can pay for supervised probation, but if you are living on the street or you don't have money, there's no, but how are you going to pay some program, some third party to supervise? You don't. And there is no supervise for most cities. So these people are unmonitored in our community. So I started seeing these problems, and it's what inspired me to step up, because we are in trouble in our state and we have to fix this. And now I'm looking at this diversion and it's everything that I was seeing coming to light even worse. And if we don't change course now, and especially with all these threats with migrant crime coming over, it is progressively getting worse. And there were a lot of people that told me, let Rachel Mitchell finish out her term. And maybe if it was 2 years, I would have stepped back. But when the phone kept ringing and I kept hearing story after story from law enforcement, from victims, from our communities, I can't step back, because 4 years is too much. I can't tell victims in 4 years, maybe we'll all run and we'll try to make it better. We have to make it better and change course now. And what you're seeing like in your community in Gilbert, there are things we could have been doing proactive that would have helped. And we didn't do that. And I think there's been a lack of leadership, because the county attorney's office should have been there from the beginning in your community. We used to do things like that. We're not doing them now.
What do you mean? What could or should the county attorney have done?
So back under the Montgomery administration, we had what was called community-based prosecutions. We worked very closely with law enforcement, neighborhood associations, with the communities, and we knew when there were issues coming up. And when there were issues coming up, we were proactive, not reactive. So I'll give you one example that came to my mind. We had a community of with a number of individuals who were Burmese victims, and they were being targeted by gangs from South Phoenix and other areas going in there and attacking them. But these people in this community didn't want to call the police because they were scared. They were scared because in their country, the police were the enemies, and so you didn't trust the police. So when we knew this was happening, we were there at the very beginning, working with the neighborhood groups, working with the community nonprofits, working with the apartment managers, working with law enforcement to identify the issues of why they were resistance to come forward, to try to build trust, to try to encourage people to cooperate with police and provide information. And we had that leadership in the community. And it resulted in justice. We identified people, we prosecuted cases, witnesses came forward and we were able to get justice. And so what I mean here is this was months of a lot of people not coming in and encouraging the youth and the people. Videos were out there, but people were scared. And I understand that, you know, I understand that because, you know, we come from a society where we've told people to mind the kids specifically to mind your own business, not to be a tattletale. Snitches get stitches. So for parents being surprised, they shouldn't be, because kids typically don't want to come forward. They don't want to come forward to parents. You know, I run a nonprofit on the side that we started after there was a murder-suicide at a local high school. And one of the reasons was in every school shooting across the country, there's warning signs on social media and the kids didn't say anything. And it's not the parents that are going to know. It's their classmates that are going to know there's a problem before any parent. So we have to inspire our youth to speak up. We have to know the power of a bystander. The bystanders can stop bullying if they just knew their voice mattered. And so I say all that because a lot of that could have been addressed in the very beginning and encouraging and being out there and letting all of our youth know how much power they have to come forward, and that being afraid is understandable. Every witness is afraid. That's why we have silent witness. And that's why we ask people all the time to come forward, from adults on down. This has been going on for generations, but we have to work together to counter that.
I have a couple other questions.
Yeah.
You've mentioned homelessness and you've mentioned the border.
Yeah.
What role does the county attorney have in addressing those types of crises?
You know, that's a great question. I'll start with homelessness, number one. Obviously, homelessness is not something the county attorney will prosecute for somebody for being homeless. But typically, when you are homeless, if you're shoplifting to support a drug habit to be able to live, that is a crime, and that's where you're impacting the community. And we have the ability to prosecute those offenses. And a lot of people mistake something. Since I told you, in my nonprofit world and in the fact that I started the very first juvenile drug court, I've been involved in addiction and substance abuse from the very beginning. And what I've noticed is we went from lock people up to, okay, we'll give them treatment first. We won't lock them up. Now it's the opposite. We're not locking anybody up at all. And they could have 8 and 9 priors and it's a drug offense. We're just releasing them and we're hoping that they'll get treatment. If somebody's on the street with no transportation, that's not going to happen.
Right.
So we have to, again, have that balanced approach to justice, and we're not doing it because we're afraid. I'm not afraid. Sometimes jail and prison will save somebody's lives. And you know how I know that? Because I've worked with enough recovering addicts who will tell me the Alpha program under old Sheriff Joe actually saved their life. And I had parents of addicted loved ones. If you've talked to them, they would tell you they were scared to death. Their loved one was on the street and the police were going to knock on the door and they were dead. They were going to tell them they overdosed and died. They were so happy finally at some point when they were in prison or jail, because maybe they'll get clean and get the treatment that they need. I want treatment in jails and prisons, but we cannot be afraid to lock people up, because if they're on the street, they're not going to wake up one day and be cured of their addiction. They will overdose and die, or they're going to commit a more violent crime because they're under the influence of that drug. That's the thing with homelessness is, you obviously, we want to help people. We want to get them off the street. We want to get them treatment. But if they commit crimes, we have to hold them accountable too. And sometimes it is their last hope, that last lifeline that they can have and their family can have, so they can break that addiction. When you see somebody who's pregnant and throws away a baby in a trash can because they're so under the influence of drugs, they're not thinking clearly. Those same people aren't accepting the help to go to a shelter sometimes because they're not thinking clearly. They don't want to lose their drugs. So having that break when everything else has failed sometimes is the only last resort, and we have to be able to do it. And it is compassionate and it is still helping them. But we have people that are too afraid to see that. And maybe because they don't have the experience I do of working in this community, that I know, and I've seen people who found the other side and been able to do that. So that's number one with homelessness. You can, when you don't use homelessness as an excuse to not prosecute anybody because they're homeless. I don't think that that's the appropriate way to go. The second thing is the border. Obviously, we don't have anything to do with the border, but I mentioned the border because look at how many people are coming over. And we don't know who they are. We don't know their date of birth. We don't know their intentions. We have no idea. A lot of their when they say almost military age individuals coming, we would be foolish not to anticipate that some of them are coming over to do bad things to us. And I think they've all said that there's security risks coming over. So we have to be vigilant, and we have to make sure that we are on top and prepared for the damage of this open border that could be something that we may not see for decades to come. I think everyone will tell you they expect sooner or later that there is going to be another terrorist attack. There's going to be an issue coming over because we have an unsecured border, and we are at risk with that. So what the county attorney can do, to answer your question, is we can make sure we're working close with law enforcement. We can make sure we're identifying these gangs that are coming over from other countries, and we use all the enhancements, and we use the full weight of the law to be able to keep our community safe.
A couple other questions, if you have time.
Sure.
If we start locking a lot more people up for a lot longer, how does that get paid for?
Well, I don't know if locking up for a lot longer, it's just locking up the right people. And also, and even if you have a felony offense and you have some jail, it's not necessarily locking everybody up just to not give them diversion. And especially with diversion, when you look at diversion, I guess it's a question here. When you look at diversion and you say 2,670 people went through diversion, 52% were successful, 47% were unsuccessful. And then you look back in a year, 15% had arrests of the ones successful. So when you're talking about continuing resources of polices and additional victims, you do have to compare that. You know, that's a cost as well of additional victims in our community, of police having to go around. And when you let people in, you have the merry-go-round in our justice system. That's a cost too. So I guess the issue where I would like to see, when I say better in the whole justice system, I want to see better treatment when people are in custody. I want us as a community, and as even though it's not my call, I will be lending my voice and fighting for it, better reentry programs when they get out of prison. People should be held accountable, but when they get out of prison, the second chance programs and the ones that actually help reintegrate those individuals into our community, some of them are amazing. We have a 40% recidivism rate from people leaving prison. Some programs have 7%. Why aren't we championing those programs? Because that's 30% of the individuals that got melded back into our society, and now they're father figures for their children. So maybe we can break that cycle. And we can then save cost in down the road, because the same people aren't committing offenses. That's where we're going to save the cost. Actually, fixing the gaps to treatment that is so needed in our society. And I won't be able to do that on my own. That is a complex issue. But having a leader who's committed, who sees the value and the need for it, and bringing the right people to the table to be able to address these issues, that is what is needed going forward in our community.
Absolutely agree. Let me ask this another way, because I don't actually understand how the budgeting for prisons work.
Yeah.
Could that be one? How does that work? How do we pay for all the people that we have in prison? Because how do we accurately predict who's going to be in prison or how much money we should allocate when crime is going up or down?
That is done not at the county level. That's the state level. So that's done by the legislature, and they proportion so much budget for that. So obviously, when you're talking about, as long as you're locking up the right people and they're violent offenders who should be locked up, the legislator should find the money to protect our community and to lock up those individuals. If they have to reallocate money a certain way, and I think the community would want that. People want to be safe. People do not like the fact that they turn on the radio and or turn on the TV every night and it's one shooting and one person murdered. It's one thing to say diversion if we can ensure that the community is protected. But at some point, there's a big difference between diversion, probation, super, you know, intensive probation, some jail as an incentive to try to deter people, and prison. We have to use all of those mechanisms available to us. We shouldn't just be so worried about cost that we are putting our community at risk because we're not filing charges. That's not anything that I believe that should happen, nor would I stand for that as the county attorney.
Okay, so the last thing I want to talk to you about is the Preston Lord murder.
Yeah.
So Preston Lord was murdered in October, at the end of October, and the Queen Creek Police Department, they brought in the FBI to help with the investigation. We haven't heard anything about the FBI in a long time. So can you tell us, what does that mean? Where did the FBI go? What was their role?
Well, that I can't really tell because I'm not part of that team but if the FBI came in, they probably came in to help. They came in to use resources because they have additional resources. Maybe they're, if it was a weapon offense, they could be trying to trace guns. This was not really the weapons one. So maybe it's more of analyzing videos, trying to make them so they're, I don't know, sometimes when videos are hard to see, they might be trying to enhance videos. That could be a role. It could be helping with cell phone or data. There's a lot of things that the FBI could be assisting with. It would just be speculating at this stage.
And is it possible that they're still involved, or is it likely that they're done?
It's not. Because charges haven't been filed, I would anticipate if they were called in that they're still at least offering to help until through the resolution of the case.
Okay. The Queen Creek Police Department Chief Bryce came out and said, we know who did it. We know who killed Preston. We know why. We've known since a week or two after the attack. Everything we've found since then has only bolstered what we know. That is what he's told us. Mm-hmm. They, Queen Creek, submitted charges to Maricopa County office December 28th, 2 months after Preston's beating. Is that time frame between October 28th to December 28th something that you would expect when we also have the police chief saying, we know who did it, and we knew right away?
That is hard to say. If they had probable cause to arrest, the question would be, did they have probable cause? They might have had a belief. Sure. But it really is, in order for you to make an arrest, you had to have probable cause. And in order for the county attorney to file charges, the standard is reasonable likelihood of conviction. That's kind of where we are, that I don't know without seeing the evidence, and it would be improper to speculate as to that. But if the police chief believed they had probable cause, they probably would have made an arrest. So knowing and being concerned that they did, or maybe they thought they had probable cause, but they weren't there at reasonable suspicion yet and they didn't want it turned down. Maybe they were holding back. I don't know. But usually they are typically in communication with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. A prosecuting attorney from the homicide division goes out to every scene, and they usually work together as they build the case.
Okay. They submitted charges for 7 different people. Does that mean, when they say that, does that mean that they have named their 7 people and what they're proposing that those 7 people be charged with?
That would be the submittal. If they submitted on 7 people, they would have, like we talked about with that Charles Ryan case, when they submitted on the class 2, they would say what they're asking the county attorney to consider. And then they would ask and they would outline the individuals, and they should be breaking down of who did what. To that, to show not just who committed the homicide, but the accomplice, or what role, if any, maybe they were they an accomplice? Did they hide evidence after the fact? Those are things that hindering prosecution. Those are the things that the charging attorney would be considering.
Will we, the public, ever know what Queen Creek proposed with those 7 submittals?
That would be on the Form 4. So typically a Form 4 is public record if there's an arrest with a Form 4. So somebody should be able to pull that up as the Form 4.
Is it public now, or would it be public later?
I think it was public when they were arrested. I believe the Form 4 usually is. But have you checked at all the county docket to see? But I believe that is, because usually when media gets it, it's a Form 4.
And because we don't have names, we don't know who they are. We don't know anything. Media doesn't know.
If they're juveniles, you wouldn't know. And Form 4s only come in if there's an arrest. If there's not an arrest, because
there's a
nasty case,
yeah,
then you wouldn't know at this stage. So if they were arrested, you would know because it would be a Form 4 at the IA court. So Okay. Because it's early on, you would not know. Now, once charges get filed, the victim should know, and a victim has a right to request under statute and pursuant to their victim's bill of rights, they have a right to request a copy of the police report. So they would be able to see that.
It'll be on the police report. Who they submitted charges for will be on the police report.
Yes.
Okay. Rachel Mitchell has told us repeatedly charges are coming soon. The last time she said that was February 20th. What does that mean? Because what we feel like it means is probably not what it actually means.
I don't know, because we don't know what charges and when. And then the next question comes in is after charges, what are the plea agreements going to look like? These are all things that we have to wait and play out. I mean, right now I'm a crime victims rights attorney, so I represent victims of crime. And that's something that's frustrating to them, because victims don't have a say in what charges are filed. They don't have a say in what plea offer is made. They can object if they don't like a plea offer, but that doesn't mean anything's going to change on it. So at this point, the community is kind of where a victim is. They're waiting to hear what is going to be done. And a victim at least has a right to voice their concern, and it has a right to confer with the prosecutor. The community really doesn't. And so maybe they'll explain it. Maybe they won't explain it.
You mentioned plea deals. Could that be happening now before charges are brought?
In this situation, I would doubt it. There are some cases that the county attorney will do risk assessments, especially some sex cases and stuff, where risk assessments are done and polygraphs are done, and they will make a plea and tell the victim, we're making this plea, here it is. But in a case like this, I wouldn't expect it, because these juveniles, maybe because there's juveniles involved. It's a little different because everything in the juvenile system is confidential. But I wouldn't expect it. I would expect filed charges to be filed, the victims to be notified, and then the normal course where plea agreements will be eventually made.
Awesome. Thank you so much for all of your time and for answering all of my questions and helping to educate all of us. I sincerely appreciate it, and really have appreciated also getting to know you.
Well, I appreciate it too. And I don't know to tell any of your listeners out there, I have to get 6,000 signatures to qualify. I did not even step in the race till like 3 weeks ago, because I felt compelled to jump in the race. I felt I had no choice to do this, but I need to get 6,000 signatures really quickly. I have till April 1st. So I don't know if you'd be willing to just post my link online. So if anyone could just help me qualify, you'll be able to learn more about me at Gina for Justice. You also, this just helps me qualify. The election isn't even till July 30th, but I hope that you've seen enough to at least want to know more and have an option out there, because you have to decide what direction we want for the sake of our community. And I want to turn the power of the county attorney's office back to the people, back to the community, and start enforcing the law and enforcing it fairly and justly for everybody. So if that is something that you would even like to see, I'd ask for you to consider at least signing my signature and help me qualify.
Yeah, we'll absolutely share that. We will share that. We will tell people about where they can put their signature. And then you said the election is July 30th, right around the corner.
It's scary. Yes, it is right around the corner. And so I'm still working during the day, because I told my husband, he said, I will support you in your run, but you can't quit your job this time. Because last time I actually quit my job because I have a daughter in college. And it's like, I won't quit my job. I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight for the victims. I'm going to fight for the community. But I could sure use some help. So if anyone out there is willing to help me and wants to even communicate or learn more, just go to Gina for Justice and help me sign my petition.
Thanks so much for listening to the Modern Divorce Podcast. Remember, anything you've heard today or anything you read online is not the replacement for actual consultation with an attorney and does not create an attorney-client relationship. Even if you called in and we spoke to you, you are anonymous and we don't have your details and you have not become a client of Modern Law. However, we would love to speak with you, or you should seek out the advice of legal counsel or counseling or any other expert near you. And if you have an idea for a show topic or you need to speak with an attorney in Arizona, you can reach me at info@mymodernlaw.com.